This public radio podcast is supported by Diana Kennedy's The Art of Mexican Cooking, the ultimate guide to creating authentic Mexican food in your own kitchen with more than 200 beloved recipes. First published in 1989, it's back in print with a new introduction.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk the food of the Philippines. With all our curiosity about the flavors of the Pacific Rim, this country's been overlooked. And this is odd, since the native foods are little like anything you've ever tasted. Philippine restaurateur Amy Besa has the story of her country's cuisine. Her book is Memories of Philippine Kitchens. Sally Schneider, author of The Improvisational Cook, has a lesson in confidence building and culinary logic, how you can tell what goes with what. Then writer Scott Hewler tells the story of broken wine glasses and the idea of a life well lived. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, there's a restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee, called Prince's Hot Chicken. And when they say hot chicken, they don't mean temperature hot. They mean ferociously spicy hot. There are four levels of hotness when you order your chicken at Prince's. The mild will burn your lips. The extra hot, I don't even know about.
So now, wait a minute. Is this fried chicken? Is it?
Yes, this is fried chicken that somehow, I think it's marinated first, so the marinade is hot, so it goes right down to the bone, and furthermore, it's fried to a nice crisp, pulls off a nice
sort of
bacon-like ribbons off the flesh of the chicken, but the outside, the crust, is embedded with spice as well. And what's so great about this chicken is that it's not just hot, it has a really delicious, delicious flavor, so that as you're tongue and lips start to tingle. You're tasting this chicken and your mouth is watering from wanting more of it.
In fact, really what Michael is trying to say is that Prince's Hot Chicken is highly addictive. There really should be a 12-step program for Prince's Hot Chicken, because once you start eating it, you have to have it again and again and again. Now, because it's in Nashville and we live in Connecticut,
right. We
can't avail ourselves of it every day. But when we were there, there was a lady who was sitting next to us at the next table, and we struck up a conversation with her, and she said that she lives 40 miles from Prince's, and she goes every day. She drives to Nashville, gets chicken, and drives home with it. And she said once she got home and took a bite, and she had mild instead of the extra hot. And she said, I got in the car, and I drove all the way back to Prince's and exchanged it for the correct chicken.
So is this one of those places where you kind of just go in and take out? You said you were sitting at a table, but is it restaurant kind of thing?
There are tables. I mean, the way there's no table service. You walk up to a window, order your pieces, quarters or halves, whatever you want, light, white or dark meat. You pay for it, and then about 15 or 20 minutes later, because it's all cooked to order, out comes a brown paper bag with your order in it. And then if there's space available at a table, you can sit there, but there are, I don't know, maybe a half dozen tables. So a lot of people just walk out and eat it on the sidewalk.
Yeah, it's a very casual place. And this is how addictive it is. For some reason, I got my order before all the people who were with us having dinner at Prince's. Mm-hmm. And the chicken, in kind of, a Southern or soul food manner, you get the piece of chicken and then you get a piece of white bread, like real, spongy Wonder Bread, sort of just on it, And I was eating my chicken because I have no manners, and there were, like five people staring at me wanting it. And I took little teeny pieces of the Wonder Bread and I gave each one of them a little piece of the Wonder Bread.
So it had the scent
they wouldn't of the attack
chicken.
Me.
It
felt
the bread is delicious because it's infused with all that spice. So it really is good.
The cook in me, the mind is just whirling right now because I'm thinking, how do they get the flavor down to the bone? They must be brining, with incredible hot sauce. sauce or whatever. But that's the thing that's interesting. You're saying the flavor goes all the way through the
chicken. All the way through. And, you know, in Keaton's Fried Chicken, which is, Michael, what? Where is that?
Statesville, North Carolina.
Thank you. Statesville, uh-huh. North Carolina. They have similarly spicy chicken, but what they do is pan fry the chicken and then dip it in a sort of a vat of boiling hot sauce, uh-huh, and it glazes uh-huh. it. But this is not glazed. I mean, this, they just have to marinate it forever. I'm not sure how they do it.
Maybe the chicken is fed chilies through its entire life.
This
may be the entire
It's
solution.
Born hot.
See, that's the difference between Lynn and Jane Michael Stern, is that we're not cooks.
We don't care. We just want to eat it.
I don't care how it gets that way. It just, there it is.
Hey, you're making me desperate. I'm here in Minnesota. I've got to come up with something until I get to Nashville.
Well, I think you should just get a plane ticket and go to Nashville.
I think you're right. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
C, that's the way to begin. H, that's the next letter in. I, that is the third C. Now you see some in the bird. K, that's fill it in. E, you're getting near the end. C-H-I-C-K-N, that there's a way to spell chicken.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know that the Sterns check in every week with us here, but you can get their food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. A recent find in our neighborhood led to a great seasonal supper, a big salad flanked by a Belgian tartine. Now, the tartine is what you have at Belgian beer pubs with the local beer. It's a big slice of chewy bread slathered with a tangy fresh cheese, and on the top are sliced radishes and scallions. Coarse salt finishes the whole deal. It's creamy, and it's crunchy, and it's peppery, and it's perfect. Well, the local find that jump-started our tartine habit was a fresh Minnesota sheep cheese made by Hidden Springs Creamery. It could have been channeled straight from a Belgian pasture. Which takes me to my point, and yes, there is one here. This is the season for fresh cheeses, so check out what's around in your area. And if you want an actual recipe for a tartine, look for Lynn's Belgian Tartine on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, while you're there, be sure to register for our new limited run e-newsletter and get information on its accompanying podcast. They're both called How to Eat Supper, and they're based on our brand new book of the same name. Now, every week for a limited time, we're going to send you a new recipe from the book, and we've put together even more tips and information relating to that week's topic on the How to Eat Supper podcast. And best of all, they're both free. Register online, splendidtable.org. Food writers insist we follow rigid rules in cooking their dishes. Cookbook author Sally Schneider gives us the rules, and then she shows us how to change them. So one recipe becomes many opportunities. And nobody spurs imaginations and builds confidence the way Sally does. Her new award-winning book is The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be back.
Now, look, you've got the improvisational gene, but a lot of us don't. So have you got thoughts about how to kind of get started thinking about improvising?
I absolutely do. The question I hear most from people who want to improvise is what goes with what?
Yeah.
They have difficulty figuring it out. They either haven't had much experience or they haven't really noticed how foods go together. So my favorite and best guideline is what grows together goes together.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple. That means the foods of a season and of a growing region tend to love each other. You can't go wrong. And in fact, they enhance each other and bring out each other's flavors. Now, for me, spring is one of the greatest examples of that. And I learned about it and this whole concept when I was in Venice in spring. In the markets there, they have everything we have bursting forth. Artichokes, asparagus, spring onions, peas, sugar snaps, pea vines, mushrooms. And we have morels, as you know, leeks. It goes on like that. Then you go to the restaurants there, and that's all they're doing. Risottos, pastas, antipasti, side dishes, these vegetables all together. And it was like, Eureka, that's all I have to do. I mean, duh, but, you know, it has stayed with me forever, for like 30 years. So that's what I do in spring. I cook with all those vegetables, and I figured out an approach where you can put everything in at once and make a kind of ragu. Uh-huh. Or if you're not feeling like it, or just two things looked good at the market, you can just use those two or even one. So I thought I'd tell you about that because it's a great technique and it also has a lot of uses.
So explain. What is it?
Very simple. Cut up a leek into circles or dice, whatever you want, and you sweat it in a pan, say a skillet, with some olive oil or butter, whatever fat you want, it could be pancetta, until it gets nice and soft. You take the lid off, you add the first vegetable you want to cook that will take the longest to cook. So say if we're doing the full tilt stew, I'll add either baby artichokes or artichoke hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Add a little bit of water because it's going to need some liquid to soften it. Put the lid on. You're basically braising it for maybe 8 to 10 minutes till it's not done, but a few minutes away from being done.
So it's almost cooking in its own juices. There's not a lot of liquid there.
Exactly. It's cooking in its own juices. You've added just enough liquid, which will eventually evaporate, to help it become tender. Then you add the next longest cooking vegetable, say asparagus, which I like to cut on a diagonal into nice, elegant pieces.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no water left in the pan, I add maybe a tablespoon or two, put the lid back on, cook that until it's still underdone. Then I'm going to add the really quick cooking ones, peas. With sugar snap peas, I also cut them on an extreme diagonal so you can see the little pea inside the pod, which is charming. It can be pea shoots, anything, or your morels would go in then. And the lid on, again, for just about a minute. There's going to be enough moisture in the pan to finish cooking those things. Take the lid off, sauté them, and then throw in whatever herbs you want. Now, that being said, of course, I finally figure out this grouping of herbs that, to me, are the ultimate spring combination and love these vegetables. That is a little bit of tarragon, Italian parsley and chives chopped up, maybe with a tiny bit of lemon zest.
They're all gentle, aren't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. They're gentle, and they seem to move towards those green flavors without being as assertive unto themselves as, say, basil is or thyme or something like that. So that's all there is to it. Now, if you want to do it, you could do just like leeks and asparagus, leeks and morels, morels and peas, using that basic approach. Now, this is the perfect side dish, and it also has a million uses. Toss some shrimp in. Toss it with pasta. Use it as a base for, say, soft-shell crabs or salmon. Use it as an omelet filling. Serve it with warm goat cheese. You get the idea. It can go all different ways, and it becomes really the focus of a menu that totally says spring.
That sounds fabulous. Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is the author of the award-winning Improvisational Cook. Now, you can find Sally's recipe for spring vegetable ragu on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, 7,000 islands and a cuisine we know nothing about, and breaking wine glasses, a sign of a life well-lived. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com.
Chicka chicka chicka.
Considering how beguiled we are by the cuisines of the Pacific Rim, it's surprising to realize that one country has been entirely overlooked. It's the Philippines. When Philippine natives Amy Besa and chef Romy Duritan opened their New York City restaurant, Cendrillon, 12 years ago, their food was brand new to New Yorkers. Now they're a mainstay. They've done a book, Memories of Philippine Kitchens, Stories and Recipes from Far and Near. Amy Besa joins us. Hey, Amy, welcome.
Hi.
Amy, we need some orientation. I think, can you explain where are the Philippines?
Well, we have about 7,100 islands, so you can just imagine. This is an archipelago. It used to be connected to mainland China. Uh-huh. So we are about southeast of China. We are due east of southeast Asian mainland. Uh-huh. And below us are Malaysia and Indonesia. So it's a major part of Southeast Asia.
It certainly is. 7,000 islands. I mean, that must mean a lot of cultural fragmentation, right?
Yes, that's why before the Spanish came in this in 1521, we were all different regions and different what they call a Muslim. It was a Raja, you know, like Datu ruled islands, and it was the Spanish that when they colonized it. They made it into one country called the Philippines, named after the king, Philip.
So the main influences that have shaped the food in the Philippines, Spanish would be the main influence. Was there influence from the mainland of Asia as well? There must have been.
Well, I think the major influence really, aside from the food, that the original inhabitants brought with them, mm-hmm. and that was the Malay influence. So it's not really an influence. It's the food that they brought with them.
Right, right.
But the major influence is really China, where the traders, the documents prove that starting the 10th century, they have been coming to the country. But historians believe that they've been coming before then. Mm-hmm. And they brought with them cooking implements and ingredients, like soy sauce, sausages, noodles.
Mm-hmm. So you have China and then Spain. And one of the things you mentioned in the book that I found surprising was Mexico. You said something about how the islands were ruled from Acapulco. Did I get that right?
Yes. Well, we were a colony of Spain for 400 years.
Uh-huh.
But Spain was too far. And they looked at the Philippines as a major source of income, you know.
Right.
And so their source of income was the galleon trade that lasted for 250 years, I think starting the 1650s or something like that. And the galleon trade was between Manila and Acapulco. And these ships just went back and forth, carrying people, food, plants, and culture. Uh-huh. And even Filipinos do not recognize this. And if I say we are very profoundly influenced by Mexico, many Filipinos look at me like, huh? But 90% of what we grow in the Philippines came from Mexico. The chilies, the tomatoes, potatoes, corn, pineapple, all these wonderful fruits that we have that Filipinos take for granted came from Mexico.
You have a chapter, Foods That Were Always Ours. Can you briefly tell us what would be indigenous to the Philippines? The several dishes you talk about here are fascinating.
Well, of course, to me, the three major dishes are the adobo, sinigang, and kinilaw. Kinilaw is like a ceviche, and that is the oldest food that Filipinos have been eating for thousands of years because we are, again, an archipelago, and Within these major islands are hundreds and thousands of streams and rivers. So the people that originally settled in the Philippines were riverine folk. They lived along the coast. And fish, you can just imagine the seafood that they must have eaten.
Yes, exactly.
They were pristine. There was no pollution, and there was so much abundance. And archaeologists have proven that. And then, of course, there's the sinigang. And the sinigang is a sour broth, and it can be made with seafood or poultry or pork and beef. And same thing with adobo. Adobo is a vinegar-based brace or stew, you know.
Usually done with the chicken or pork, right?
Yes. And to me, they are not just dishes. They are methods of cooking. And they are all united by the common flavor of sourness. Whereas the adobos are made with vinegars, the sinigang are made with sour fruits, and the kinilaw, you can use both.
So this sour taste, is this one of the things in your own mind you identify as being truly Filipino?
That is very Filipino. And if you look at all the other dishes that use something sour, the whole point of making a dish is finding that balance. You start with a sourness, and then you offset that with something salty, something bitter, something sweet. And you're always looking for that balance.
Amy, as a visitor to the Philippines, if I were lucky enough to be invited into someone's home, what would I experience?
Well, that is the best way to experience Filipino food, because what makes food very delicious is not just the ingredients, but how it is given and served to you. And that Filipinos are legendary in their hospitality and generosity. And to me, without that, food is not delicious.
Amy, thank you.
Thank you, too.
Amy Besa is co-author of Memories of Philippine Kitchens, Stories and Recipes from Far and Near. Well, we had to have that adobo recipe from Amy. So she left us with the most popular one in the Philippines, chicken adobo. Now, you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our new limited run e-newsletter and get information on its accompanying podcast. They're both called How to Eat Supper, and they're based on our brand new book of the same name. And best of all, they're both free. So register online for the whole package, splendidtable.org. Writer Scott Hewler spends a lot of time focusing on things most of us don't think very much about. He's done a book on the history of marine wind scales and weathermen. He's profiled NASCAR racing and the Cleveland Browns football team. He also ponders the inanimate things, like a simple wine glass.
Somewhere between the dishwasher and the cupboard shelf, a wine glass breaks. Maybe I swing wide and tap the counter edge. Maybe it's slippery and I just drop it. By the time I sweep up the pieces, I don't even remember. It's not important. Or not to me. If we break a wine glass, my wife cringes, attributing to the glass an importance I don't understand. I believe the opposite. The occasional broken wine glass is a good omen, a sign of life well lived. It means your wine glasses are seeing use, that you're toasting, cleaning, rinsing, dropping. A good thing. I'm no wine snob, but wine means so much to us. We drink it with family and friends, at worship, in celebration. No surprise that at Jewish weddings, we celebrate by breaking a wine glass. Wine flows through our lives like blood through our veins. And so as I sweep up this broken wine glass, I remember a story about not a glass, but a bottle of wine. My friend, novelist Dan Gerino, has told it many times.
When I got married in 1982, one of the gifts my wife and I got was this very nice, expensive bottle of wine. And rather than sort of drink it right then, we saved it. We were going to open it for a special occasion. And, you know, and special occasions kept coming and going. I mean, there was the birth of a child. There was our own first anniversary. There was the birth of a second child. And we kept sort of, none of them quite seemed the really big once-of-a-lifetime kind of special occasion. And others came. When I got my first book published, I thought that would be a special occasion. But, you know, the call you get from your agent, is that the special occasion? Is it when the contract arrives? That's just paperwork. Yeah. So again, there was no perfect special occasion.
Dan used to tell this story at book readings to demonstrate that the life of an author wasn't as filled with celebration as one might think. The times I followed him to the podium, I used to say that the story demonstrated only that Dan Gerino didn't drink enough wine. An easy laugh. Then the story grew more complex.
And then what happened is that at 20 years after getting that bottle of wine, my wife got sick. She had a headache one day and couldn't shake it. And after a while, she went to the doctor, and the doctor found multiple brain tumors. She had metastatic melanoma. 4.5 months after being diagnosed, she died. And I realized there was never going to be a special occasion worthy of that bottle of wine. And I didn't know what to do with it.
Not long thereafter, I myself got married. We broke a wine glass and everyone cried, "Mazel tov! Good luck." Shortly thereafter, Dan and I met for lunch, and he brought a gift in a brown paper bag. A bottle of wine and two glasses.
I decided that the perfect gift would be this bottle of wine and a couple of wine glasses. And that would be part of the gift. The other part of the gift would be that story, with the lesson being that you don't put off that kind of indulgence. Enjoy this with your wife at the first possible opportunity. Take this bottle, take these glasses, and don't make the same mistake I did.
The paper bag was handed from one moist-eyed guy to another, and I brought home the bottle with strict instructions. We were to drink the wine and smash the glasses. Well, we tried. Dan had worried about how well the wine, Chateau Margaux 1978, if you're wondering, worth $200 today, had aged. Suspicious, drippy-looking marks on the neck raised questions, which the first gentle tap of the corkscrew answered. The withered cork dropped instantly into the wine, which had gone horribly bad. The wine went down the drain. The empty bottle moved to the top shelf in my office, a souvenir of something, and the two glasses, unbroken, sat in the back of our cupboard. Marked for their single use, we couldn't defile them with the stuff out of a box we usually drink, but neither could we break them before they had done their job. Fortunately, time goes on, and even despite heartbreak and tragedy, it has been mostly kind. My wife and I have been married now for 3 years, one little boy, and an uncounted number of the cleanup projects that speak of a fortunate life. And so we got to thinking. Dan is doing well. By now he even has a steady girl. To clear out those two unbroken glasses, maybe instead of waiting for a special occasion, we ought to get a new bottle and two more glasses. I went to a wine store to replace that Chateau Margaux. I learned, and spent, a lot more than I planned to, but let's just say I ended up with a Bordeaux from Saint-Estèphe, the slightly lower-rent region right next to Chateau Margaux. We arrived at Dan's house and decanted the wine to let it breathe. But it's a funny thing. We set to eating some Cajun creation of Dan's, and an hour later, okay, we took out the special glasses.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. So happy to.
This is great. Yeah.
Damn, that's good.
And of course it was good. We drank the whole bottle. Dan took a moment to explain that the custom of smashing a wine glass comes from toasting a bride and destroying the glass so that it may never be used for a less noble purpose, but we never really thought of our own noble purpose. We were just four friends happily killing a few bottles of wine, and that seemed to be purpose enough. Still, we had committed ourselves to using those glasses only once, but who wanted to clean up a mess? So instead of smashing them, we trooped down to the pond at the back of Dan's yard.
One, two, three. It may never be used for a less noble purpose. Unless somebody's going to wait out there and get them.
I suppose this means we've all learned Dan's lesson, that the best honor you can give a bottle of wine is to drink it. And I hope a little of my own lesson comes along, too, that the wine glass means less than the wine that's in it, and they both mean less than the hand holding it. And when a wine glass sees its final use, whether you drop it, crush it underfoot, or fling it into the pond, you should always remember, it's good luck. Mazel tov.
Scott Hewler's newest book, No Man's Lands, is about the travels of Odysseus. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, at a dinner party in 18th century France, what might your wine glass be in? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, at a dinner party in 18th century France, what might your wine glass be in? Well, the glass could have been tipped into a wine rinser. Now, these were deep glass bowls the size of a cereal bowl with lips at opposing sides of the rim, and they always had water in them. Wine glasses were much smaller then and expensive. Hosts frequently didn't have different glasses for each wine, so they would put out wine rinsers. You'd rinse your glass between wines by turning it upside down into the water and hooking its foot on the lip. Wine rinsers are now major collectibles, and the oldest one I have seen is from England from the mid-1700s. But the oldest proof that the French had their wine glasses in water goes back to a 1735 painting. It's An Oyster Lunch by J.F. de Troyes. It is a pure party painting. It shows a bunch of young guys partying with the latest new drink, champagne. And as everyone in the picture looks up to see the cork fly from a newly opened bottle, you should look down at the table, because there, amid the piles of oysters, are small bowls of water with wine glasses tipped into them. Because that was the other main use of the wine rinser, to chill glasses for the bubbly. Pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who have we got on the line? We have got Kit from Louisville. Hey, Kit, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. And in Colorado, we put the S in it.
Louisville.
Louisville, yes.
That makes a lot of sense. I've always worried about that S.
not to worry. Lynn, I'm doing I'm cooking for a fundraiser. People are paying the big bucks to come and eat my cooking. And
that says a lot for you, you know. I mean, this is pretty impressive.
It's 30 people, so it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do Italian, but I wanted to do something that I can prepare ahead. I had thought of chicken cacciatore, and my significant other says it's way too pedestrian.
Your significant other is a dear. I love it. Okay, let's think now. You need something you can do ahead, and you need, obviously, you don't want to break the bank here either, right?
I mean, exactly.
Yeah, you don't want to do steak a la Fiorentina.
So. Exactly.
Let me think. If you're going to do a sort of traditional Italian meal, you do want to have a separate course of pasta. The thing about pasta is it is never a side dish. It stands on its own. But here's the good news. You can take almost any pasta recipe and you can bake it. I mean, in some words, you don't have to do a lasagna to do a pasta head that's not going to be sacrificed. Because pasta, if you're going to serve pasta that is not baked, it must be made at the last minute. So right. To start there, I mean, you could have antipasti of a puree of beans and garlic with fresh chives, you know, things like cannellini beans. They come in cans. They're dynamite for this. A little lemon, lots of fresh chive, a bit of garlic. You puree that. You have little small toasts that you've grilled and you've just brushed lightly with olive oil. That can all be done ahead. You put that out for people. It's utterly delicious.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very simple. You can have some good olives. You get your hands on good olives. You rinse them and you bathe them in some really tasty olive oil and you grate lemon over them. Mm-hmm. And you put some fresh basil and you stick
just the zest of the lemon.
Uh-huh. And you put that in the refrigerator overnight. You take it out and that's out at room temperature along with your puree of the white beans that have been flavored with fresh lemon juice and garlic and lots of chives. And you have the little toasts that people can spread it on. That's light. That's really fresh. You know, you can do that and it'll be fabulous. People will love that. And you can do an inexpensive wine. It's a bubbly wine. It's called Prosecco. Mm-hmm. And you've probably had it. It's very popular, not going to break the bank, but it feels so festive. And if they've paid the big bucks and they're thinking they're not serving, you know, Dom Perignon, and you can smile and say, ah, but in Italy, this is the sparkling wine everybody drinks. Now,
there you go.
Then you can do a pasta course, and your pasta course could be something like there's a recipe, I think, on the website for this, and I think it's called Sicilian Shepherd Sauce. It's in my my book, Country Table, but this is the basic idea behind it, and you do this all ahead. You do this like 2 days ahead. The sauce, in fact, you could do a month ahead and freeze. The sauce is a tomato sauce, but it has a difference. It's done with celery, carrot, and onion, and chopped salami. And you slowly get that nice and browned in a big skillet. Okay. And if you're doing this for 30 people, you want to figure one recipe is going to feed 10 to 12 people. Okay. Because you're serving them in very small quantities. This is very tiny. And the idea is you're going to make this spicy tomato sauce. It has red wine in it. It has rosemary and sage. And here's the key. It's tossed with penne. Okay, those little tubular pastas, which you can get everywhere. And then what you're going to do is you're going to put it in a casserole and you're going to put one layer of the sauce in the pasta and then you're going to put spoonfuls of a good ricotta cheese and some cubes of mozzarella and then another layer of the pasta and another layer of the cheese and another layer of the pasta and you're going to finish it off with the cheese. When you bake that off, the ricotta ends up tasting almost like cream. And the mozzarella becomes this creamy, stretchy fabulousness. Mm-hmm. And as you spoon small, small portions, little portions, they will be going crazy.
You got me going crazy.
Well, they will never have tasted anything quite like it. And then there's a great thing here. It's filling. So what can follow it could be your chicken idea, but why not do roasted chicken with orange zest and tons of crushed fennel seed and garlic and white wine? And you roast that in shallow pans. You can do this ahead. You could have chunks of red onion there. You could have sweet red peppers. You could have even little turnips, you know, the turnips of the season now that are cut in small cubes. You could have carrots. And you roast that slowly together until the chicken is browned and you're basting it all with white wine and you've sprinkled it generously with olive oil and there's a ton of black pepper on it. And that is not a cacciatore, but it's going to taste like a sauté. But if you set out to make a sauté like a cacciatore, you're going to be browning chicken until you're green. And you're going to, and you're, you're going to work so hard on the dish. It's going to be such a pain to do for 30. When they walk in, you're going to want to throw everything at them and say, I'm going to bed, you know, leave. So what you do is make the oven do the work. Spread it out on shallow pans. You can roast it in, you know, layers. You do one batch and then you do another. But you can do it 3 days ahead. And then you can reheat it in the oven.
Right. Oh, excellent.
And you keep basting with its own juices. And you do it in shallow pans. You try to get that chicken, you know, a little on the crusty side. And you cut up a chicken so it's in smaller pieces. And you have a fabulous meal. And then with that, because you've already got some veggies there in the thing, you could just do simple boiled green beans with coarse salt sprinkled over them. And you serve them at room temperature right next to that chicken on the plate.
Mm.
And then dessert could be a lemon curd with fresh bay leaves. I'm running lemon through here because it's the season to be for lemon. It could be a fabulous, on the website, I think we have 16 versions of this recipe. It's called Double Dark Chocolate Torte, Signora Bimbi's Double Chocolate Espresso something. The idea is it is like a brownie that has gone to Italy and come back so fabulous. It has espresso in it, and it has black pepper in it, and it has three kinds of chocolate, and that you have to make ahead.
Anything with the Brown Food Group is a good thing.
Yes, exactly. And at the end of a meal like this, give them chocolate. They will know that you walk on water. It's that basic. They're going to love it. And you're not going to spend a fortune.
And not pedestrian.
And never pedestrian.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hey, Kit, you're welcome. Enjoy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. Rule of thumb when you are cooking for a crowd. If the recipe begins by saying, brown the meat, you don't want to do that. We've got Dan up. He's calling from Seattle. Dan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'm really excited because I was in Italy for a couple of months and went to some wonderful chestnut festivals, and I picked up this amazing chestnut flower honey. And what's interesting about it is it has a very bitter undertaste, and it's got this kind of woody sort of flavor. When I tried pairing it with gorgonzola, It actually cancels out the bitter taste of the honey, so you can't really even appreciate it. So I'm trying to kind of figure out, you know, what exciting recipes, ideas you might have.
Oh, it is. I have not had chestnut flower honey in a long time, but it is the one I've had came from Tuscany. But it's made probably wherever chestnuts grow, which is all over central and northern Italy. I think it is one of the most distinctive honeys that you'll ever find. I'm so glad to see you like it, too.
Oh.
The way it's used a lot in Italy is in not blue cheeses necessarily, but cheeses like a medium-aged pecorino, which would be something that has nuttiness to it and some firmness. It is also incredible drizzled over fresh cheese. And, I mean, everything from a French Explorateur or any of those, you know, fresh triple creme cheeses to something like even a really incredible ricotta. Because that bitterness played against the creaminess that you get from a fresh cheese is just sensational. The other way to use it is make panna cotta. And streak it over it. Because, again, it's the creamy against the bitter and the sweet. Roasted pears is another favorite way of using it. You toss the pears with olive oil and sugar and cinnamon. You want to use wedges and even some sage leaves, believe it or not, or rosemary. And you do a really high roast, like 450. And the idea is that you want the pears to caramelize slightly and that sugar on them to caramelize. And they're not mushy, but they're a little firm, but they're really starting to get caramelized. And you just streak those pears with just threads of that honey, and you'll think you've died and gone to heaven.
And is that at the very end? Or all
No, you serve it that way. You don't put it on while it's cooking, when you put it on the plate. Mascarpone cheese is another place for it. You see where I'm going with it.
Yep, I got it.
So medium-aged cheeses, so that would put you into the Fontinella, the Fontina, the really great Gruyères. I'm not talking about, you know, supermarket Gruyère, but really wonderful imports. Things like any of the Tomes. Tome is usually a fresher cheese, but sometimes it's aged. Any of the Tuscan Pecorinos. Any of the Pecorinos from anywhere, but you don't want the super aged salty ones. You want the medium aged ones. All of those would be wonderful with it. And of course, the other place is there's a wonderful chestnut. We would call it a cheesecake. It's a baked chestnut pudding that has a lot of ricotta in it. And you serve that streaked with this. So the idea is you serve it with chestnut desserts. You will just plots.
Beautiful. Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Oh, use it. Enjoy it. I envy you having it. Right. And by the way, the last time I checked, I think it was like $25 a jar. So you have got gold.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care, Dan. Bye-bye. Bye. You know, either pay your mortgage or you buy the chestnut, honey. You can call us 800-537-5252. Mas Masumoto and his family grow organic peaches and grapes in the Fresno Valley. He's also a highly regarded author who writes about his life on the farm. But his latest project is adopting a peach tree. Mas, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, adopt a peach tree. Why adopting peach trees?
It was an opportunity for people to come to the farm, and the main thing is experience harvest for themselves.
Is this a way of getting free labor, maybe?
Almost. What it is it's an opportunity for people to have some ownership on some peaches. And the way it works is people apply. They fill out adoption papers and apply to adopt a peach tree. We accept them, and we do reject some because we take this so very personally. And they get a peach tree in the spring. And throughout the spring and summer, I send them monthly field notes, which update them on how their babies are doing. But the main thing is they have to be here for delivery, for harvest. And that's how they come and actually pick the fruit for themselves. And they could know what it's like to enjoy the bounty of our peaches and also make that wonderful decision of when is a peach ripe.
So they get a chance. For instance, if I come out ready to pick and I look and I think, you know what, I'm not going to pick all those peaches from my tree yet because some of them are still green.
That's exactly right. What we do is we work this over two weekends in late July or early August, and you can't pick the whole tree at the same time. And that was part of the experience I wanted to convey so people could understand how a peach naturally ripens and how they could enjoy trying to live with nature and make those decisions. One of the most complicating things for people is that I can't predict months ahead exactly those harvest dates. We don't do Caesarean peaches on our farm. So they have to wait and see when it's ripe. And about 3 weeks before, I could send out a notice saying, yeah, it's going to be this last week of July and first week of August. And they'll come for two consecutive Saturdays, bring their friends, their picking team, as we call it, and enjoy this harvest.
How many peaches do you get from a tree?
A full-grown tree could have as much as 800 to 900 peaches. Last year, people had about 400 to 500 pounds of peaches.
Wow.
So one of the questions in the adoption papers that people fill out was, what do you do with 200 pounds of peaches? Because we're assuming people would split the peaches one Saturday versus another. And people wrote delightful answers. And really, part of the answer is you learn to give away a lot, which is part of the fun lesson, I think, of this whole experience.
So what were some of the delightful answers? I mean, were they just saying that they would share the peaches, or were there
a lot of people started going back into their family cookbooks and saying, I remember my grandmother and used to can peaches or jam peaches or make some kind of chutney, or understanding, you know, can you bake a lot with this? And of course, so people were frantically baking with them and making wonderful pies and cobblers and different sorts of things. And they find ways to sort of spread the harvest around throughout the year. So if they throw some peaches in early fall, they could have these, you know, wonderful tasting peaches. Oh. Or in the middle of winter, they could put some peach jam on a muffin and then close their eyes and relive that harvest experience.
You're bringing back that peach tree that we had in the backyard when I was a kid. I remember the smell of the leaves as you climbed up the tree to get the peaches.
It's exactly, it's that whole experience that's involved. And this peach that I have, it's an old heirloom variety called Alberta. And people who have memory of peaches will go, oh, I remember Albertas, because they're rarely grown commercially anymore. So this sort of even more throws them back in those family memories.
Oh, this sounds wonderful. Thanks so much for talking with us, Moss. And I envy being, I wish we lived closer. We'd adopt a peach tree.
Oh, maybe sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Moss Masimoto is author of Letters to the Valley, A Harvest of Memories. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Art Buchwald, who said, I like champagne because it always tastes like my foot's asleep. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes, trenchant tips, and stories from some of our favorite guests. Check it all out online, you know where, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.